Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each day we bring you a passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength, insight, and wisdom in everyday life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com.
I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next-to-listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. If you had asked me 15 years ago, would I be doing a podcast with today's guest? I probably would have said, what's a podcast? But I would have been very excited because this book, The Moral Animal by Robert Wright, was a total quake book game changer for me. It introduced me to the concepts of evolutionary psychology and so much more. I didn't know that many years later, he'd write another favorite book of mine, Why Buddhism is True. Robert has been a longtime influence of me, I think a modern philosopher and political thinker of great value. He also has a newsletter that I strongly recommend. It's one of the few that I get every day called Mindful Resistance. You can check that out, mindfulresistance.net. The idea being that, and this is a very Stoic idea, we have to be politically engaged, we have to be civically involved. But how do we do that rationally? How do we do it courageously? But also, how do we do it without making ourselves miserable and unhappy and giving into despair? So I don't think we don't get particularly political in today's episode. We do talk about the idea of being involved in politics, which of course is essential to the Stoics, Marcus Aurelius and Seneca most of all. And we talk about being a creative, controlling your own destiny, and the temptations and the distractions of social media. I loved this interview almost as much as the book. It was weird preparing for this interview. You know, here's like, I even have these little flags here. Here's some highlighted passages. Here's an arrow, a note I made to myself. It was like having a quick little conversation with myself 15 years ago, which felt surreal. And I feel lucky to be in this position. Feel lucky that you guys are listening. Enjoy this interview with the great Robert Wright. Check out mindfulresistance.net, and you can follow him on Twitter at Robert Wrighter, W-R-I-G-H-T-E-R, and enjoy. I wanted to start this by going way back. This is my copy of The Moral Animal, which I bought in 2005.
Wow, it looks as if someone's actually read that.
I'm gonna pick some sections that I highlighted 15 years ago. Because as I was going back through it to prepare for this interview, something I found a passage that I think one might think, what does the ideas in The Moral Animal, which is my favorite book of yours, connect to your work on Buddhism? But I thought this passage ties to something I just had someone on the podcast talking about. You say, we are built to be effective animals, not happy ones. Of course, we're designed to pursue happiness, and the attainment of Darwinian goals, sex, status, and so on, often brings happiness, at least for a while. Still, the frequent absence of happiness is what keeps us pursuing it and thus makes us productive. Darwin's heightened fear of criticism kept him almost chronically distanced from serenity, and therefore kept him busy trying to reach it.
Yeah, it's kind of the problem that Buddhism highlights, I think, which is that we always want more. We always want things to be a little better than they are. I mean, you know, gratification happens, and that's part of the engineering of natural selection, is that we do feel good upon attaining goals. It's just that the gratification is designed to evaporate so that we will keep pursuing goals.
Yeah, I've used this example of someone like Elon Musk. If Elon Musk was happy at PayPal, that would be good for Elon Musk, but probably bad both for capitalism and for the world. So the system, it's almost as if we've designed the perfect system to optimize for achievement and accomplishment, and the exact opposite of the system that you would want for human happiness or contentment.
Pretty much. I mean, I guess the exact opposite would be for us to always be depressed and anxious. And it's not quite that bad.
Sure.
We do get these little rewards doled out to us. But it's true that I think people of high achievement very often are people for whom the gratification is particularly fleeting. So that's kind of bad news for them in a way, and I guess often good news for the rest of us, depending on what you think of Elon Musk and his tweets and the whole package. But anyway, sure. Let's stipulate that Elon Musk is good for the world for purposes of this analysis. Now there are people who seem pretty happy and say they're pretty happy and get a lot done, but I don't know. I don't know. What drives you? Why do you keep doing stuff?
Yeah, it's if you and I were happy just putting out one book, what would we have done after that? Life would have been empty in some ways. Life would have been different in some ways. I guess the place to get to, and I'm not sure if it's possible, but I think it's worth striving for, is can you get to a place, and this is, I think, both Buddhist and Stoic, where you're driven, but not by the external rewards. So mm-hmm. you actually enjoy whatever it is, the thing that you're doing. So if Elon Musk is, and this example falls apart, I'm sure, but if he's actually just enjoying the process of starting companies and making a difference and so on and so forth, that's different than the NFL player who's motivated by the trophy. You know, do you actually enjoy showing up every day in the practice and the game and the strategy, and it doesn't come at the cost of other things? That's philosophically a better place to come from.
Yeah. And, you know, I think to get back to Buddhism a little, I think one idea behind mindfulness meditation is it helps you get better at experiencing and enjoying, you know, the day-to-day just journey, as opposed to only the destination. On the other hand, it does sometimes lead people to reduce their level of achievement as conventionally measured, and which is fine. I mean, it's up to them. I would personally, ideally, like to have it both ways, and that's the trick.
Well, I would like to have it both ways too, and I sometimes question myself, like, is it a sign of enlightenment or philosophical progress that, say, you are less motivated by the external rewards of a book? Like you say, hey, I don't care how many copies this book sells. I don't mm-hmm. care whether it hits the bestsellers. Is that enlightenment, or is that fear or laziness masquerading as enlightenment? That's a question that I often ask myself.
Yeah, well, I think on the one hand, the hypothetical kind of enlightened person by the lights of Buddhism would not particularly care. But at the same time, I'm sure there are a lot of people who manage to not care or convince themselves that they don't care and are not enlightened. It's such a challenge because so many of the rewards offered by the world are not worth paying attention to. I mean, you see this on social media, you know, it's like, if you look, like, these days in a highly polarized society, what does it take to get a lot of Twitter followers? you know, it takes making the problem worse. That's what you get rewarded for, is making the tribalism problem worse. That's the easiest thing, the easiest way to pick up followers. So I encourage people not to obsess with conventional rewards, I guess.
Well, I want to talk about politics towards the end, but I think that that is an interesting point, which is, like, I think you and I both know people who maybe a few years ago, they were in a similar place than us, you know, sort of in the hierarchy of author, intellectual, whatever, who really decided to get into the political social media game. Mm-hmm. And they've been rewarded. They have a lot of followers. Maybe they get in the news a lot. But I've also seen how it's transformed them as a human being. It's almost turned them into a machine that does nothing but tweet. When you look and you go, my God, did that person tweet 78 times today? And then you think about how impossible it would have been to do any other work while doing that, or to be present with their family. You think about mm-hmm. how much news they would have had to watch to generate these hot takes. So it's not just, you know, is the accomplishment worth the reward, but also is the accomplishment worth the cost and the transformation that one has to undergo to get it?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's tough. One thing we're built to like is social affirmation. I mean, as much as any other single thing. And you know, especially during a pandemic, you go online to get it. And what are the forms of social affirmation available online? Not all of them are healthy, you know. So we can blame this circumstance for some of that, I guess. But I do think, I mean, again, I think mindfulness is a good tool to try to bring to social media. Try to pay attention to the way you're reacting to tweets and things. And if you're tempted to retweet something, ask yourself why you are. I mean, that question, you know, the answer to that can be informed by just paying attention to what's going on in your body as you're experiencing the thing.
Well, this is a little bit Epicurean, and I tend to think that Epicurus sits right in the middle between the Stoics and the Buddhists on the spectrum of philosophy. But he says, ask yourself, what will you feel after you get the pleasure? Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're lusting after something. He goes, what will it feel like right after the orgasm, right? Which I think is, so evolutionarily, all evolution needs you to get to is that thing. Evolution doesn't need to have an answer after, because you've already done it and you can't take it back.
Right.
And so there's this, what the mind can do is sort of rise above some of these desires and go, I'm going to put out this retweet. And there's a part of me that's telling myself it will feel good. I'll be rewarded for doing it. But how typically do I feel after I retweet something or tweet whatever pops into my head? Usually you feel disappointment or self-loathing or frustration. You feel some non-positive emotion. And that's what makes you do it again and again for some insane reason.
Yeah. And the disappointment always comes sooner or later. If nobody retweets it, it's immediately disappointing. And if there's a flood of retweets, there's still that moment where they quit coming. You know, you just kind of can't win. And it's so easy. I don't know. Maybe I'm atypical and most people are better than this. It's easy if you're not careful to really spend a lot of time monitoring the feedback in real time. I mean, yes. I've started to make a point of kind of like, I haven't been tweeting that often, but like I tweeted something this morning that was kind of critical of the way the Wall Street Journal presented a vaccination story. And I just made a point of putting my computer in airplane mode after that. So I just wouldn't be aware of the short-term reaction.
Which is in a way one of the healthiest things. I think it's almost like being an author is the most healthy way to produce stuff, because there's no immediate gratification. It's not instantaneous. And you don't really have a relationship with the people who buy the stuff, because there's so many intermediaries. It's almost the most psychologically sound way to be a content creator.
Yeah, it's funny. I hadn't really quite thought of this before, but I used to think of myself as ideally suited for my career, because I would write books, and I'm an introvert. I don't need a lot of social interaction. I'm fine with being alone and thinking. And I think I was well suited to writing books, but then modernity arrived. I mean, if you define modernity as the post-internet age, and increasingly part of being, you know, a journalist, a writer of not, you know, just kind of in the game is being on social media. And mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, it used to be that back in the golden era of physical magazines, people would, whether they were paying you to write a piece or actually hiring you to be on staff, the understanding was your job is to produce the content, then you can go home. Our job is to promote it. We bring the audience, right. You produce the stuff, and now you're actually expected to do both. It's a full-time job, and that second part of it, promotion, I am not well-suited to, and I don't enjoy.
Well, I have two more passages I want to read from The Moral Animal, and I want to get credit again for a 15-year-old highlight.
Nothing brings more joy to my heart, however fleeting it may be, as we've just discussed, than to see the yellow highlight marker having been applied to a book I wrote.
So this is again feels rather philosophical. Darwin wrote in his autobiography of a habit he called the golden rule to immediately write down any observation that seemed inconsistent with his theories. Quote, for I had found by experience that such facts and thoughts were far more apt to escape from the memory than favorable ones. And then you say, like a lawyer, the human brain wants victory, not truth.
Yeah, so Darwin was aware of confirmation bias before we called it confirmation bias, apparently. And a big theme of that book is that the human mind is unreliable as a guide to reality. It is in some ways just our lawyer, you know, wants to make the case for our interests, and it does that most effectively if we're not aware of all the evidence against the claim that we should have whatever it is we'd like to have. You know, I mean, the generic point here is that natural selection did not design the human mind to see the world clearly per se. You know, I mean, it designed the mind to have the kinds of thoughts and perceptions that were conducive to getting genes transmitted. Now, often that does involve seeing the world clearly. It's like, it's not good for your genes to walk off a ledge, right? But even there in the realm of kind of everyday safety, you see how the mind can be designed to depart from a strictly accurate view of the world. So people tend to overestimate the speed of approaching objects. Okay. So they're actually in error, but you can see why the mind would build in that bias. It's better to get out of the way too soon than too late.
Sure.
But there are lots of ways in which we see the world clearly. It's just that, and I think psychology has become more and more aware of this lately. I mean, more and more people have heard about cognitive biases. Those are built in for a reason, and you'd need to be conscious of them to try to prevail over them.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, that the sort of philosophers they love this idea of rationality. And then what I think psychology has shown us in evolutionary psychology is just how profoundly not our friend our brain is. And to me, nothing illustrates this more than cognitive dissonance, right? So it's like you have a belief, then the world shows you truth, right? Like you have a hypothesis, you have a belief, whether it's that the world is going to end because that's what your cult says, or, you know, mm-hmm. that, you know, that Donald Trump and QAnon theory is going to be this or this on this date mm-hmm. at this time. So mm-hmm. you have some idea, and then the world shows you truth. If your brain was your friend, it would accept truth as it is presented. But in fact, your brain does the exact opposite when shown mm-hmm. a truth that threatens your identity. It actually doubles you down on the false belief, which is a pretty, to me, incredible illustration of just how at odds we are with our own thoughts day to day.
Right. Although, you know, it depends on what you mean by the brain being your friend. If your brain was going to be your friend in the sense of telling you the truth, You're right. It would be impervious to these biases, and if you had a belief that on November 3rd Donald Trump was going to win an election, and that was going to enable him to root out a bunch of Satan worshiping pedophiles in the government, you would abandon that belief if he lost the election. That's all true. At the same time, if what you want is to be like part of a group,
sure,
and get the affirmation from that, and if being your friend is keeping you, you know, sustaining that social dimension for you, then in the short run, at least, your brain is being your quote friend keeping you on the same wavelength as the tribe of yours that is continuing to believe in the false narrative you believed in. And again, it gets back to the fact that during evolution, having a social group, having its esteem was correlated with getting genes into the next generation. It may not be now, but that doesn't matter.
Right. No, it's your brain is your friend in the sense of you ask your friend, hey, have I been putting on weight or how do I look? And they tell you, you look amazing. What are you talking about?
Right.
It's the friend that lies to you.
Your brain is that kind of friend. Yes. And that can hurt you in the long run.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because you shut a truth up. Eventually it does, you know, you're really just deferring it with interest is the way I think about it.
Often. But you know, there are people who die while the, you know, the still a lot of, you know, the, sure, they're ahead. I mean, you
right.
know, it would be easy to say, it would be nice for me to believe that in the long run, clarity of vision is always rewarded. But there are people who are, you know, deeply immersed in false narratives and good at purveying them. And in a certain sense, it works out for them their whole lives. And that's a sad fact.
All right. So this is my last section. And to me, this seems like the most prescient passage of the whole book. You say this Darwinian brand of cynicism doesn't exactly fill a gaping cultural void. Already, various avant-garde academics, deconstructionist literary theorists, and anthropologists, adherents of critical legal studies, are viewing human communications as discourses of power. Already, many people believe what the new Darwinian underscores, that in human affairs, all or at least much is artifice, a self-serving manipulation of image. And already, this belief helps nourish a central stand of the postmodern condition, a powerful inability to take things seriously. You're sort of arguing it on the other way, like that there's this sort of postmodernism that sort of making everything ironic and that there's sort of a nihilism in that. I would argue we've kind of swung the other direction where we have a nihilism where everything's awful, everyone's evil. You know, it's almost an exaggeration of all the evils and problems of history to the point where it's sort of like, what's the point of waking up in the morning?
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought before this moment of the irony that a lot of evolutionary psychologists are super down on the kind of culture warrior, social justice warrior, cancel culture deplatformers kind of, because the criticism of these people, and of course these are academics who I mean, I've taught a little at the college level, but it's not what I do. These are people who are at college, and so they are like tormented by these people. It's understandable.
Yeah,
they're antagonistic toward them, but I just now appreciated the irony that these, and I know these evolutionary psychologists. I remember back in the 1990s talking to them at these conferences on evolution and human behavior, and we did share the kind of worldview you've just described, which is that in a certain sense, you know, human communication is about power. Powerful people sometimes manage to have their narratives prevail and so on. And so that is a fact, but you're right that idea has been taken so far in some circles that, it's been taken farther than these evolutionary psychologists think is appropriate, even on intellectual grounds. And it's also been taken far in a way that they have found kind of unfortunate in their everyday lives as academics. So there is that irony. But anyway, I think I certainly believe there's such a thing as taking this too far. Especially if you go so far as to quit taking seriously the idea that there is such thing as the objective truth about things. And I'm not saying we can ever be sure we've got the objective truth about things, or it's realistic to think we can get there very often. But I do think that's a good ideal to keep in mind, and we can do things that get us closer to it.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorn sponsored today's episode. Thorn takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorn, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorn. Go to thorn.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorn.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. You almost look at some of these academics and it's like they've almost been sort of paralyzed by their own analysis and their own explanations. Like this is the scandal of the day. And who knows? I think we're always taking these things much bigger deal than they actually are. But, you know, San Francisco, as always, is supposedly renaming a bunch of schools or suggesting they rename some schools, whether it's Abraham Lincoln or whomever. But one part stood out to me where it was like they were changing the name of an art department at a school because it was an acronym, and acronyms themselves are apparently symbols or parts of white supremacist culture. And so what struck me about that is not whether it's true or not, because it's like obviously not true, but it just struck me as like, I almost felt some semblance of pity for the person who would make that argument, because I think they're actually making it in good faith. But just imagine if your mind when all you have is a hammer, all you see are nails. Like, imagine a mind that's so looking for something that it sees it in an acronym, and then it cancels out the ability for acronyms to exist. I mean, it's almost as if you're shutting doors until there's no doors left, and you're just trapped in a dark, empty, meaningless room.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. My brother actually graduated from George Washington High School in San Francisco, which is no longer going to be called George Washington. And I went to junior high about a block from there. But so I was definitely keeping tabs on this story. And as you suggest, the more surprising thing is Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
That name is not even surviving in San Francisco, which, well, my whole view on this is maybe not worth getting into. I do think my own tendency is, first of all, to try to judge people in the context of their time, because I know this is a tangent, but yeah, but the reason I think you have to is because I think there has been moral progress over time as a pattern. And as a result of the moral progress, the further back you go, the less likely it is you're going to find anybody worthy of approval, because things, you know, things have progressed. And by the same token, if you can judge people that way, you should recognize that, that if God willing, moral progress continues, we will all someday be judged as unmentionable on whatever grounds, maybe because we've eaten meat. Most of us have at one time or another, whatever. So that's a tangent, but you were talking about the whole, I mean, I do have a reflex that may bother you a little, which is that I always look when I see things like that that seem crazy to me that people in some other tribe are doing. I do look for things that my own tribe is doing that are at some level comparable. And I think usually you can find those. I mean, part of the generic problem is that, again, it gets back to the mind not being designed to apprehend the truth necessarily. I think we are all inclined to, if we say something and it gets us more social affirmation, we say it again. Right. And we say that, and we repeat the kind of thing that was. So, for example, during the whole Trump era, I identified on the one hand with the anti-Trump tribe, but I thought that the resistance was not really behaving. The resistance I was nominally part of was not behaving all that wisely.
Sure.
And you would see the same kind of thing where people would start saying, you know, Trump is a Russian stooge. He's a Putin puppet. And they would get retweets for that. So they would just say it more and more and more. And I'd be like, you know, it's possible to find a smoking gun, but I haven't seen one yet. And then you get to the end of the Mueller report and there's no smoking gun. I'm not saying there couldn't be a connection, but one was never found. And so that became kind of a tactical setback for the resistance, a source of huge unhappiness. And I know the example you gave me of people saying acronyms are evil because, you know, sure. I've seen whatever it is. I've seen white males use them or some. I don't know what the logic is.
Right.
But as crazy as that sounds, it is. I do think it's a species of this one thing that, you know, people like if people nod when you say something, you say it again and you say it more intensely. And we all have to be on guard against taking social affirmation as our guide.
No, that's, I think what they're doing is they're taking a logic that's worked in some contexts and just inexorably applying it to every situation mm-hmm. until eventually you get to such a laughable extreme, but you don't even realize that you're way off the reservation at this point.
Well, because the social affirmation is coming from your own tribe. I mean, it may Correct. Also be that you're having success with respect to like the establishment you're trying to tear down because they do agree to rename this and this and this, but the main thing is that until your own tribe quits giving you the social affirmation, that's why these things can go on so long.
Yes. And this is where, and I've seen this a number, I have actually more friends who have been sort of radicalized on the right than on the left. And I've watched, you know, I knew a number of people who were sort of in the dating community. So they were already a little bit politically incorrect. Right. And then as we started.
Wait a second. This is news to me. Is it politically incorrect to be in the dating community?
No. Like in the dating coach community, let's say.
The
pickup artists and such.
The kind of player community. Yeah.
So they're already a little bit politically incorrect. So then as society becomes more politically correct, even though they haven't changed, their position is now more extreme. So then the incentives are, do you disavow who you were to try mm-hmm. to be part of the mainstream group, the politically correct group, or does it push you more towards the extremes? And so I think it's even interesting when you look at some of the figures or the right-wing celebrities involved in the insurrection of January 6th, they were not, even 4 years ago, as politically radical mm-hmm. as they are now. It's mm-hmm. that they were pushed, they were marginalized more and more and more, and then the incentives said, well, I have no chance of resonating over here. If I put out a tweet, there's no chance of normal people liking it. I actually have to go more and more and more extreme. So I think this is right. This has happened on both ends of the political spectrum, which is that the incentives of social media, the incentives of your tribe, drive you to be more and more extreme until you're almost unrecognizable from your former self.
Yeah, well, this has been kind of a hobby horse of mine. I mean, I did have this during much of the Trump era, I had this newsletter called Mindful Resistance. It's been renamed the Non-Zero Newsletter. But the idea behind the original name was that the resistance should be mindful, you know, for one thing, in the everyday sense of the word, of just being aware of the consequences of what you're doing. And the more you single people out from the Trump tribe for ridicule and act as if they are typical of all Trump supporters, the more Trump supporters are going to just kind of buckle down and, as you suggest, identify more intensely with their tribe, look more to their tribe for affirmation, and hate our tribe more. So I think my side, you know, bears a certain amount of the blame.
Yeah, and I like the concept of mindful resistance. I want to talk about newsletters too, but because I think mindful resistance is a great concept, whatever it is that you're resisting. So let's lowercase resistance and just mean resistance to anything, not a specific political resistance. There's that Nietzsche quote where he says, you know, be careful when you fight monsters that you don't become a monster yourself. Mm-hmm. I think you've seen a number of people, regardless of whatever it is they're campaigning against or wherever they are politically or socially or philosophically, it's like once you pick a side, then your inherent reflexive resistance to the other side can actually make you more and more extreme as you go. And so you need the ability to sort of step back. There's a story I tell in my book, Lives of the Stoics. There was a Stoic philosopher named Diotimus. The Epicureans and the Stoics were rivals, you know, sort of opposite schools. Mm-hmm. And he's under the impression that the Epicureans are repeatedly libeling and slandering the Stoics. And there was supposedly this very aggressive school head of the Epicurean school at the time. So what does Diotimus do? He ends up writing these fake letters as if they were written by Epicurus that he puts out into the world, where, and they become so popular that they really cement Epicurus's reputation as being a hedonist. So it's totally untrue. But ironically, it's him committing the exact crime that he is accusing the other school of being guilty of, right? Sure. And so there's this temptation we have where if you're not mindful of your resistance or your opposition or your competitiveness, you can really end up becoming the thing that you hate.
Sure. I mean, like, again, I mean, right now, a lot of people are accusing Trump supporters of being conspiracy theorists. Some certainly are. But the Trump supporters turn around and say, well, you guys had this conspiracy about Russia, which just wasn't totally borne out. You know, it's hard to do, but I always encourage people whenever they're annoyed by something the other tribe is doing to just try as an intellectual exercise to find examples of it in your own tribe and even in your own life.
So before we go back to the newsletter, I am curious about this difficult balance of being sort of philosophical and political, because it might seem like the best way, the most Buddhist thing you could do would be to tune out politics entirely, right? To sort of to focus inwardly. Again, as the Epicureans did, right? The Epicureans said, we're going to retreat to our little garden. We're going to focus on our little pleasures, and we're not going to be sullied and distracted by all these pointless things. The Stoics are much more politically engaged. The Buddhists are somewhat politically engaged. But how does one participate politically and maintain their, I don't want to say philosophical purity, but let's say their philosophical principles?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a couple of questions that are kind of floating around. And I mean, the one question is like, will the specific philosophical stance of kind of Buddhism, mindfulness, does that naturally take you out of the game? Some people think it can, that it does. It can tend to. I don't think it has to. I recommend that people who are practicing mindfulness try to stay in the game, because I argue they're better equipped than others typically to play a constructive role. The Sam Harris just did a had a thing about this on his podcast. I think the complaining about readers who thought that mindfulness was incompatible with being a political activist and with his own kind of confrontational approach to it.
Sure. He maintains a similar one.
What's that?
I have a similar approach. Yes.
Well, you don't strike me as nearly as confrontational as Sam, if that's what you meant. But I don't know. You're kind of asking set aside mindfulness. You're kind of asking, I guess, can you remain true to any kind of coherent set of philosophical principles while really still getting in the political fight and mixing it up? Is that it?
I think that's part of it. I'm not even talking about policies. It's almost if the point of sort of philosophy is to have equanimity and inner peace and, you know, focusing on the big picture, you know, all these sort of things that are, I think, core to Buddhism and core to Stoicism. It almost seems like being on Twitter, following the news, having opinions about things, if you're not the president, is almost, I don't want to say hypocritical, but it's somewhat contradictory.
Well, it's challenging, and I guess I'd say it's hard to. I mean, if we are going to talk about this from within the framework of kind of mindfulness Buddhism, it's very challenging to engage in a way that's consistent with those principles, because for one thing, you have to rule out kind of ad hominem attacks, which is hard because they're effective, they're crowd pleasers, and they're tempting, right? We don't like the people that we disagree with adamantly, right? We want to think they're bad people. So that's hard. It's hard to be really, you know, intellectually honest, to not oversimplify the things you're arguing against. It's all hard. It's also hard to just refrain from engaging sometimes when that might be the wiser course. It's hard. It's very, life is hard. That's my conclusion.
No, I love that, because, and maybe how I've started to think about it too, is it's like, and I think you talk about this in Why Buddhism Is True. It's like, you should be able to be mindful and philosophical as you, let's say, do the dishes or sit in traffic. So, yeah. Why shouldn't one be able to be philosophical and mindful as you debate a contentious political issue? I mean, isn't that the point of these things, right? And you were saying that actually what you want is more mindful people engaged in politics. You don't want the, if the mindful people leave politics, who are you ceding the floor to?
Right. You have to do your best. It's a very challenging time, because you can see that there are these positive feedback cycles that are just making the situation worse and worse, right? So, like, you know, again, you get affirmation from within your own tribe by demonizing the other tribe, by taking really aberrant examples from their tribe and acting as if they're typical. Mm-hmm. That antagonizes the other side and makes it only truer that on their side, you will get affirmation from demonizing the other side. The rewards for demonization grow and like, you know, the process reinforces itself in this cyclical way. And I ask myself how, you know, sometimes if you ask how these things are reversed, the answer is the society hits rock bottom. Sometimes that means like actual civil conflict, and they finally recover from it and go, well, let's try to find another way. But, I wonder, you know, could you have like a grassroots movement or something that made it its mission to, you know, that within which people gave each other affirmation and reinforcement for being good citizens in the way we're describing?
Well, I almost wonder if part of the resurgence of Stoicism and Buddhism and the popularity of your books and my books has to do in part because people are realizing that the system is not working, that to be, that you know, perhaps religion used to play this role for a lot of people, but also some civic norms and your social clubs and such, that as these old structures have fallen away, people are hitting that individual rock bottom and they're going, look, these things are important to me, but I'm wearing myself to the bone, or I'm making myself miserable, and I need some spiritual help, or I'm going to go insane.
Yeah, but the challenge is to keep those people from dropping out entirely, right? Yes. I mean, because that is the most obviously effective therapy, is to just either get off social media or just change your social media feed so that it's all about, like, you know, bowling or something. And the challenge is to convince people to try to, you know, retreat to the extent necessary to regain their equanimity, you know, but then try to use the equanimity constructively by reengaging at least, you know, periodically. And it's, I mean, it would also help to have a kind of a rule book for how do you engage productively. I'm not aware of one, but it's hard.
Well, this is more common in your philosophy than mine, but, you know, the sort of, maybe a metaphor here is the Buddhist retreat. You go on a retreat, it's silent, you're away from the world, you all the things that were driving you nuts are gone, and so you are able to maintain your equanimity. And to a certain extent, you could maintain that equanimity if you never left. But the whole point is that you have to go back into the world.
Right.
Marcus Aurelius talks about, he says, you know, you can't, he's like, you think, yes, you could go get peace by going to the beach or the mountains or the country estate. He's like, but actually you have this within you at all times. It's in, but you have to look inside your own soul. And that's like the elite level, is can you get equanimity on demand wherever you are?
Right. In Buddhism, at least in Mahayana Buddhism, there is this idea of the Bodhisattva as kind of an extreme example. Is the Bodhisattva is somebody who could have enlightenment. That's how far along the spiritual path they are. They could just live in nirvana and, you know, in the cycle of rebirth and everything, but they choose to go back into society and engage. You know, they're almost... they're kind of like saints in Catholicism, I guess, or something. But I mean, I'm, you know, most of us aren't so close to enlightenment that we can do exactly that. But the ideal of resisting the maximally comfortable life in order to go back and help the world is a good one.
Got a quick message from one of our sponsors, and then we'll get right back to the show. Stay tuned.
Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80. That's 80 to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. Yeah, I've told this story before, but I think there's an interesting contrast in, you know, sort of Buddha is a prince, Marcus Aurelius is effectively a prince. One of them renounces their sort of patrimony, the other embraces it, and they both get to philosophical enlightenment. Mm-hmm. But there's essentially two different paths. One is sort of the world, and the other is kind of apart from or above the world. And I'm not sure which is right, but there is something I think the world needs the sort of spiritual insights of a Buddha, of the sage, of the monk, the Thomas Mertons of the world. Mm-hmm. But the Thomas Mertons of the world can only exist if there's the Marcus Aureliuses of the world, the people who are doing the work and running the system. Like you can't, if everyone is a monk, things fall apart pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I mean, that example reminds me that another thing we could use, not just people who go back and engage on social media in good faith and in a principled way, but we could use more people in politics who are admirable. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's a real problem. You know, I mean, look, we all, you know, as we get older, I think it's natural to think that things have gone downhill. Things used to be better. And maybe I'm imagining it. But I certainly think that politicians didn't used to be as conspicuously obnoxious and disrespectful towards their peers, for one thing, and as just trollish as they are now. It was a different set of rewards that they were, that the system was different. You know, they were, maybe you could say they were getting rewarded for being civil, and that's true. And the question becomes, how do you restore that set of incentives or something? But I don't think we're imagining it when we look at the, you know, the politicians out there and think that we could do a lot better.
Well, Neil Postman says that you get the politicians that you're dominant cultural medium incentivizes, filters. And it shouldn't surprise us that we had a reality show/ social media star president when those are our two dominant cultural mediums.
No, that's a perfect example. And I wish I had more answers.
But maybe, I would argue that, you know, we thought we were in a golden age of television with HBO and Showtime. But actually, Netflix and these streaming services have unearthed a totally even superior, because the economics are different, right? You subscribe to Netflix, there's no commercials, they have unlimited space. So perhaps, maybe this is, I'm just making this up, but maybe the hope is, well, now that as the dominant cultural mediums are streaming services, podcasts, et cetera, paid subscription newsletters, which I want to, let's talk about now. Maybe in a few years, we start to get a breed of politicians or leaders or artists that those mediums incentivize, which I would argue, and I talked about this in my book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, I would argue those are better economics for content and civility and humanity.
I hope that turns out to be the case. And look, you know, we should give ourselves a little time to adjust to radically new things. I mean, social media are brand new. And it was natural that they would design algorithms that optimize for engagement. And it was not necessarily predictable how bad the consequences would be. Now, what you do about that, I would like to whatever extent possible, avoid highly intrusive government regulation. But that doesn't mean there aren't things we can do. So I mean, there is, you know, we should give ourselves a break in that sense. I mean, the problem is things are changing so fast that if we get the social media thing figured out, as you've suggested, there will be another thing whose consequences we don't foretell.
Yeah, you need the sort of the beef and the meat trusts of the early 20th century were a natural outgrowth of the technology and the incentives and the economics. And you needed the political will to regulate or rein those things in, and maybe we're at that place.
Yeah. I hope so. And I do hope some of the things you're talking about could make things better. It's a good sign that they are at least part of the conversation. Like, mm-hmm. you know, the people at Substack make their case as, you know, they say that they are kind of an antidote to some of the ills of social media. And we'll see, but at least we can judge them by that.
I agree. I love, and I've subscribed to the newsletter since you put it out. What I love about it is it's like, it reminds me of the early days of blogging before social media, where you would get something delivered to you. It was thoughtful and it helped aggregate and present to you a lot of information that saved you a lot of time of searching. So I loved it. It's like, hey, there's, you know, let's say you put 30 links in the newsletter. There's usually an article sort of from you at top and then a bunch of links, and maybe six of the links are interesting to me. And I save those to Instapaper and I read them on my phone 3 days later. It's not the instantaneous viral element. It's here's a thoughtful person whose opinion I respect giving me, distilling down some wisdom and then giving me some homework, so to speak.
Yeah. And there are, you know, I'm impressed. There are a lot of good newsletters out there. It's becoming a very rich ecosystem. I think it will evolve. It'll be interesting to chart the evolution because I now have a paid version of the newsletter that's new and it comes out like multiple times a week. And then the kind of the version you're describing will still come out about once a month for free. And so far, it, you know, the experiment's working okay, but I don't think this can go on forever, that people can keep, you know, paying like $5 or $6 a month to more and more and more
sure.
people, right? And so I think I think it'll be interesting because I think you'll start to see a kind of aggregation, like several newsletters combining, and you get them all for $9 a month or whatever, and you know you'll have something a little more like magazines. And I'm kind of toying with trying to do something like that. You're seeing versions of it, and I think it'll be interesting to see if you see the reemergence kind of magazines in a kind of organic way, in a kind of grassroots way.
There's something both Stoic and Buddhist. It's kind of an eternal recurrence of like new technology explodes something, breaks it apart into 1,000 pieces. And then somebody comes along who hasn't heard of how it was before and says, you know, what would be amazing? What if we took all these millions of pieces and we put them together into one big thing? And then, right. You know, it's funny how we're just repeating the same thing over and over and over again. And we don't even realize it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd be okay with that. I kind of enjoyed the era of magazines.
Well, I've been doing the Daily Stoic newsletter for 4 years. Every day I do an email about Stoicism. And it's interesting because I did the book 4 years ago, one page a day, and then every day for 4 years I've done the email. And the other benefit for it is, I mean, I've written to these people every day for 4 years.
That's amazing.
So, sometimes my editor will, my publisher will say, well, I don't know about, and it's like, no, this isn't a discussion. I know. Because I have you have the real engagement with the thing. So we were talking about, you know, one of the benefits of being a writer is you're so disconnected. But one of the upsides of the newsletter is that you are connected and you have a sort of a bond or an intuition about what the audience wants because you're actually interacting with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's interesting. One feature of going paid. And I mean, again, you still have the two audiences. You have a smaller number of people who are paying, and then you have the larger number, and you send newsletters out to them too every once in a while. But I'm trying to reorient myself to, you know, the idea of like writing for people who presumably like really like your stuff. I mean, they're paying for it, right?
Right.
And it's a different. I mean, the Substack, their philosophy is that when you're writing for paid subscribers, just relax. You don't have to fuss so much over the style and over drawing them into the piece. Like they like you, You know, you're more, and their philosophy is that you should work really hard and perfect the pieces that are going to be publicly available, and then they will draw people into your orbit, and, you know, they'll go viral, draw people into your orbit, and blah, blah, blah. But it's something I'm still kind of wrapping my mind around, the idea of an audience that likes me, you know.
It is a bit strange because we have a paid component of Daily Stoic. It's not on the Substack model. It's you get some extra emails and some other bonuses and stuff. And I really like doing that. But there is a weird part too, where as a writer, and this is where you have to do some work on the ego, is like you spent your whole life, your whole career wanting to reach as many people as possible.
Exactly.
So then it's like, wait, you would think like, should I work? If your first part of the ego is like, well, I should work less hard on this because it's for less people, but it's actually the exact opposite. It's like, no, these are the people that really matter. And you have to put out of your mind whether it's for 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people, because it's actually about the true fans, so to speak.
Well, the Substack people, when they're trying to lure you into doing this and doing a paid model, because after all, that's the way they make their money. I mean, they say you can be casual with your true believers, so you won't have to spend so much time on the newsletter. I'm just not finding that that's really the case. I mean, I just still care, and I try to do a good job. But you're right, there can be a frustration when you're like, okay, I think this piece was really good. But wait, it can still only go out to X number of people. There's no way it can like really catch on in a bigger way. And that's, the kind of timeless pieces, I can kind of wait a while maybe and release them into the wild. They can become part of the unpaid newsletter at the end of the month or something. But still, it is a trade-off, and it's a new way of thinking about it, and brand new for me because this has only been going on for like 10 days.
There was another weird thing I had at the beginning of the pandemic. I wanted to do this piece about how Marcus Aurelius responded to the Antonine Plague. And, so I reached out to someone who's published me at the New York Times before. And I said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this piece. And they were like, well, I'm really busy. Like, contact me in 3 weeks. And then, and it was like, okay, so then this, again, this is the ego part. So New York Times, great. The reach of the Times is great. The status of the Times is great. You, as a writer, your impulse is to go to all those things. It tickles all the all the triggers. But then it was like, wait, I send out an email to 300,000 people every day who are interested specifically in this thing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's who not only is that who I should write it to, I can send it to them right now. And so there's also something about the newsletter thing where it's not about social media followers. It's not about publicness. It's are you speaking to the people that you're supposed to be speaking to? But there's something, I don't want to say less rewarding about that, but there is something that challenges the ego about that you have to wrestle with.
Absolutely. And I did even, but before I went paid, I mean, I would still, somebody would approach you about writing something. And I basically say, look, if you can think of a way there's synergy with my newsletter, one way or another, like if your author's bio is prominent, it's at the top and it links to my newsletter and more people will become aware of my newsletter, fine. But if that's not the case, I mean, I just had this devotion to building up the newsletter. And it's true that like, suppose you do write a piece for prominent venue and a lot of people see that one piece, but you're not like capturing them, you know, they're not becoming, an enduring part of your milieu. For better or worse, sometimes I think I'm crazy and I should just stick with what I did 20 years ago, which is write for the most prominent places I can write for. But
I think it's the opposite of crazy. I think you should be doing exactly what you're doing. And I think if there's any writers or podcasters or whatever listening, if you don't own your audience, you don't have anything. You know, you're owned by the outlets, or you're owned by, you know, the market. You want to control the audience, and you want to speak to them directly and regularly. That's autonomy. And the whole point of a writer is to control, to be a writer, a creative, or an artist, is to control your own destiny, in my opinion.
No, it is autonomy. I mean, it's freedom. And that's become, kind of more, more salient as the whole kind of cancel culture thing has unfolded. I mean, I think there are more journalists, writers who worry a little about what exactly they can say on this platform or that platform. And I'm not like, you know, breaking a whole lot of new bounds. I don't go about trying to violate speech codes, but it's nice. It's just nice not to have to worry about getting fired. There's nobody who can fire me.
Right. No. And yeah, sure. Some really extreme cases, they've been kicked off of Patreon or whatever, but it's like, those were really bad. Those were like,
I'm not in that territory.
Yeah, no, it's like, try to cancel me. I have direct access to my audience in multiple different mediums, right? Like, try to cancel me, you know? And I think that's the place that you want to get, because that's a place of strength and resilience. Whereas if you're surfing the wave of whatever the sort of intellectual trend of the moment is, or publication of the moment is, you're very vulnerable, and things can be taken away from you that you think you own, but you don't own.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed the part of my life where I was, you know, doing, you know, more like New York Times op-eds and, you know, writing for Time and the New Yorker and stuff. And I'm glad it happened, but I slowly came to wonder how much influence I was having, because it's like, okay, so I'm writing this piece from this point of view for the New York Times op-ed, but they've got kind of one slot for that particular piece that month. And if I didn't write it, somebody else would. So am I really adding that much? So I'm enjoying the new environment. It has its challenges. But
no, and if it wasn't creating more value for them than it is for you, they wouldn't be having you do it.
Right. That's true too. And that became truer and truer. I mean, I remember a time when all these places paid really well, and then that became less and less true too.
Well, I love the newsletter. I love the books. I've read all of them. I love this one especially. But here's my very old copy. So I appreciate it. We'll have to do this again.
Warms my heart. Thanks so much for the time, Ryan. I really enjoyed this.
Thanks for listening to the Daily Stoic Podcast. Just a reminder, we've got signed copies of all my books in the Daily Stoic store. You can get them personalized. You can get them sent to a friend. Whatever you want, we'd love for you to have a copy. I know I love signed copies of some of my favorite books. If you love a signed copy of The Obstacle is the Way, Ego is the Enemy, Stillness is the Key, the leather-bound edition of the Daily Stoic, we have them all in the Daily Stoic store, which you can check out at store.dailystoic.com. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture-themed trophies for six basketball-related activities.
Trophies like the Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill, you might win some, but you just lost one trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.